Good afternoon. We have our third and last case for the day, 09-AP-2784, Mark Klim v. American Transmission Company. And we have a lineup of speakers, and so we're all on the same page. 15 minutes for Attorney Vanderwall, 10 minutes for Attorney Roth, 30 minutes for Attorney Streck, and 5 minutes rebuttal for Attorney Vanderwall. Right? Okay. Then we're going to start with Attorney Vanderwall, representing Mark Klim and Gene Klim.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Shane Vanderwall, and may it please the Court. I represent the petitioners Mark and Jeannie Klim. And we are here today on a case that I want to clarify that litigation expenses are not just compensation. Litigation or expenses are an aspect to make the owner whole if an owner whose property is condemned by a condemning authority is forced to litigate to seek just compensation. In the instance that the owner is forced to seek just compensation and achieves the benchmarks set out by the legislature, $700 and 15%, he is entitled to be made whole through the compensation of litigation expenses. This case, under WSSTAT section 32.062A, is in some ways the typical case that I believe the legislature was aiming to prevent. That is, it's a small dollar amount case. The Klims received a certificate of compensation and accepted a certificate of compensation for $7,750. Within the statutory time, 6 months, the Klims filed an appeal and achieved an award of $10,000, thus meeting the minimum requirements under 3228 3D litigation expenses. And as the appendix has shown, those litigation expenses that the Klims incurred were in fact $22,000.
Well, litigation expenses. But didn't you settle on $30,000 as a total?
Ultimately, we did, Chief Justice. The $30,000 was in exchange for the Klims not to appeal the Condemnation Commission award and to argue this sole issue before the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, and now this Court.
And the sole issue being attorney fees.
The sole issue being costs. Litigation expenses, right, so. Under 3228 3D. Subsection 2A is particularly relevant to small dollar cases like this. It assists the condemning authority in getting the project done much quicker and able to get into the field. What, respectfully, the Court of Appeals and American Transmission fails to appreciate is that during the 2A phase, and as acknowledged by the legislative history in WSSTAT Section 3206, the bargaining power and knowledge of the parties is unequal. The burden, contrary to what ATC has submitted, the burden is not on the property owner. The property owner is land is being taken against their will. The burden is on the condemning authority to arrange for fair appraisals by qualified appraisers. The issue here is that one of the primary issues here is whether WSSTAT 3228-3D is ambiguous.
But you have two courts that are saying it's absolutely plain and clear.
And Chief Justice, I am of the position, I was and still am of the position, that the plain language of the statute allows for litigation expenses.
Oh, so now we have three.
have three.
You
and this is the position we've taken. And I do acknowledge that this court has found in cases that by the time a case reaches this magnitude, there obviously may be some ambiguity in the statute.
It's only if, let me say, not only if the interpretations are reasonable, but if the people are reasonable. So we've got to, that's
correct.
Not exactly correct. That's not our law.
That is correct.
Counsel, but looking, could you focus on the statute? And I have it in front of me, and perhaps the other justices do. That is 3228.3d. Walk me through the language with your interpretation, and then use that as an opportunity after that to tell us how yours differs from the other interpretations. That is the interpretation of...
Oh, mine is right and the other ones are wrong?
How yours differs, counsel.
That's a simple explanation, but you can expand that.
3D begins, the award of the Condemnation Commission under WSSTAT Section 32.06 sub 8. I'm not going to focus on 32059. That's a transportation matter.
Okay.
And this matter arose under 3206. It was a American Transmission and a power line case. 32.06 2A states that a property owner has 6 months from the date of the filing of the certificate of compensation.
Hold it. Maybe you need to do that. Can you walk me through the language, or do you need to give this parenthetical stuff?
I can walk through. The award of the Condemnation Commission under 32068, which is what is other than transportation matter, exceeds the jurisdictional offer, which isn't here, or the highest written offer prior to the jurisdictional offer by at least $700 and at least 15%. In this instance, there was no jurisdictional offer, so there was nothing to exceed in the first part of exceeds the jurisdictional offer. But then the language states, or the highest written offer, which is what we have here, prior to the jurisdictional offer. And that's what happened here.
Well, you don't have any jurisdictional offer.
No, but there was a written offer which was accepted.
Absolutely.
By the Clems. And obviously, if there is a written offer that's accepted, there would be no jurisdictional offer. And the operative language I submit to the court is the word or. Or, as the justices are aware, is a conjunctive word that means that does have content and means other or alternatively, whereas the Court of Appeals focused on the word the right before the jurisdictional offer.
The second time.
The second jurisdictional offer, the second the in that line. But the article the does not necessarily always need to imply content. Some type of prerequisite has to occur. I believe the focus of the statute is on the conjunctive or, not on the article the.
Well,
and that's where, Your Honor, my main disagreement with the Court of Appeals opinion is.
If I understand your brief and your argument and why you wanted to go to 2A before 3206-2A, before you went to 3228-D, was I think you were going to tell us that there are two ways of getting to circuit court or the condemnation commission. One is through this, what is it called, agreed amount?
Agreed price.
And that doesn't involve a jurisdictional offer, is that right?
Correct. Well, it ultimately will not.
Okay. And so you get the agreed price, you file, you record the deed, right? The easement here?
The easement, yes.
And then you record the certificate, right? Okay. And then you can appeal to circuit court, and there's a condemnation commission, and you proceed from there, right?
Correct.
Okay. An alternative way of getting to the condemnation commission is through a jurisdictional offer, right?
Not accepting the jurisdictional offer, correct.
Right. And from a reading of D, the Court of Appeals said D only applies in this second way. Isn't that the point?
That is their point.
That's the ultimate point.
That is the ultimate.
And you're saying can't be. That couldn't be what this is designed to do because it has a bigger policy implication in the legislature. That is, that the legislature wanted to give the condemnee litigation costs when the condemnation, when the condemnor wasn't fair in making an offer.
Not only does there the legislative concern, which I've counsel briefed, but also in, I submit to the court, the plain language of the statute states that as well.
Well, now, I look back, and plain language of the statute refers to jurisdictional offer in the first part. It refers to jurisdictional offer in the second part. So you can argue you don't get there without a jurisdictional offer. But I looked at the legislative history, and the second part, or the highest written offer, was put in by the by legislators, not by the council.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
And how do you read all that? I mean, what is your argument as a result of the drafting or the legislative history?
The result was, and I pointed this out, I believe, in my response brief. If you look at 3206 sub 2A prior to the legislative acknowledging this legislative history, there was no appeal procedure. The statute didn't talk about a certificate of compensation within 6 months. The statute didn't say that after that certificate of compensation, the case should refer to the Condemnation Commission. But after 1978, October 1st, the new law, that language was specifically added. That's what assists me. And when we're looking at the plain language, as this court has said, one of the things we look at is the structure of the statute, which is what the circuit court did and the legislature did in 1978. The two routes, Chief Justice, you're talking about is exactly what the legislature wanted to happen, and this case takes that first route, the 2A route. And because the Clems did seek the 2A route, they did incur attorney's fees. Those attorney's fees were necessitated by them in their attempt to get fair and full value. They did not get fair and full value by the agreed upon price. That's proven by the Condemnation Commission award. And under this court's ruling in Standard Theaters, we should and must start from the premise that the owner is entitled to legal fees, in part is because the power of eminent domain is an extraordinary power and requires the rule of strict construction to the benefit of the property owner. The purpose, in other words, Your Honors, is to make the property owner whole. So they do not have to go and dig into that just compensation fund. That's what the legislature wanted to achieve. I believe that's what the legislative history that has been submitted in this case evidences. And that's what the Clems have sought. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Roth, Robert W. Roth, representing the amicus curiae, the eminent domain attorneys.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Your amicus landowner attorneys are humbled and thankful to be here today for both the court's acquiescence in allowing us to be here and the Clems for seating us this time.
Thank the Clems because they seated time. Okay.
I did. Just now. I ask why I'm here. And I believe it's because I must bring up another point to the court. The heart and soul of this case rests in the Warehouse 2 case. And it rests in Judge Rogensack's decision at page 103, where she states, in permitting recovery of litigation expenses, the legislature sought to provide the condemnee with just compensation by ensuring that he or she would not be forced to use part of the award to pay for litigation expenses after successful appeal.
Now, I agree with that. But if the legislature really wanted that, they wouldn't put all these bells and whistles about when you get litigation costs. They would say you get litigation costs all the time.
As we parse the words of the and ask ourselves why the legislature sometimes does what it does.
Well, it's even more than off of the. It says, in lieu of costs, litigation expenses shall be awarded to the condemnee if... And that was all the language we read. And then there's another clause. And neither party appeals the award to the circuit court. Stops them from litigating.
As I speak to this, and I think about what you're saying, I go back to the Nankin analysis that we had, the Nankin case analysis. And as difficult as it is to tell what the legislature had in mind, I don't think the legislature had in mind an arbitrary classification or subset of condemnees who, by virtue or dint of the fact that they arrived at an agreed price situation, rather than doing nothing, which is absolutely allowed in Chapter 32, and then you would absolutely receive a jurisdictional offer, that that subset would arbitrarily be denied the right to litigation expenses. There is both the statutory interpretation and the question of equal protection in this case. And the equal protection component arises from the discussion in the majority opinion in Warehouse 2. The way in which the case focuses on B. Frank speaks to the reinforcement of the decision to liberally construe statutory provisions regarding eminent domain. The policy of fairness, why should one subset of condemnors be assured of being able to recover litigation expenses only by doing nothing? Because if you do nothing as a landowner at the front end of an eminent domain case, you will get a jurisdictional offer. You're assured of it. You're protected. You will get it. But if you enter into a negotiation under the duress of imminent threat of litigation, under the power of eminent domain, and you enter into an agreed price at 32062A, you're denied litigation expenses. And the interesting part of the whole process comes down to the fact that in 32062A, there is a provision for appeal. The reason that's there is to remind us that that provision still represents an understanding of the unequal bargaining position. The fact that the landowner cannot be made to be able to be on an equal footing with government when we are taking property from them. So that's not a contract. That's not bilateral. It's not an agreed price in the sense of, well, a couple of people haggling in the bazaar. It's not. It's not about goods and services. It's about the taking of property rights and returning them to the government for public use.
Now, what are you doing? Are you arguing that this statute is contrary to due process? Equal protection?
Hardly.
They're the same in terms of analysis?
Thankfully, the Nankin case provides a roadmap for me to discuss this. And in the short period of time, what I've chosen to do is focus on the fact that the disparate impact of creating a subset seems to violate the concept of equal protection. It is, you sort of create an arbitrary result by forcing the interpretation of the language in 3228.
Counsel, if I were sitting as a circuit court judge and listening to you, I'd say, oh, are you challenging the constitutionality of the statute? And have you put the Attorney General on notice?
Well, no, I don't think so, at least not as it relates to this argument today.
But you're not challenging the constitutionality of the statute?
I am challenging the constitutionality of this statute if the interpretation is as the appeals court created. In other words, the circuit court didn't rule that way. So when you asked me that question and you said, how would this fit in the circuit court, I had the problem of realizing it was the appeals court that found this what I consider to be arbitrary construction. So that raised the equal protection issue for the first time. If I was all the way back in the circuit court and it was reversed, Justice Bradley, I might have had to have done that.
Well, I don't know that you're saved by arguing it here, but I'll check that.
Well, what you're really arguing is that the statute has to be interpreted in a constitutionally sufficient manner, correct?
That is correct,
and
Justice.
So you're not making a facial challenge to the Constitution, and in a way what you're essentially saying is that the Court of Appeals applied it in an unconstitutional manner, which really doesn't require notice on the Attorney General.
I would believe that to be correct, Justice.
But it's for every case. Every case that involves, every single case that involves the non-jurisdictional offer approach is what you're challenging.
Yes. It's the creation of a subset of people who, by virtue of their status, became unable to collect litigation expenses.
Okay.
If there are no further questions from the justices.
I have questions.
You're not going to get
off that easily. If there's no further argument, I'll have a question. And that is, looking at the statute, the last phrase of the statute about neither party appeals to the circuit court, and I understand that's the situation here. Neither party, by agreement, neither party appealed to the circuit court with regard to the compensation. But what do you do here? And neither party appeals the award to the circuit court. Seems like that was met here. What's the meaning of that?
Why? I believe it has a specific meaning, Justice Bradley. It has to do with the finality of the condemnation award. When a condemnation commission award comes out, you have 60 days to appeal it. And if you appeal it, then sub D drops out of the statutory scheme. And you're in a different circumstances. You've skipped into sub E. And so I believe the purpose of that language was to make clear that you would have finality of a commission award. Otherwise, you go into sub E.
You think that the purpose is to have finality of the commission award or have finality of the whole thing? That is, not to have further litigation in the proceeding. Now, you've carved out, okay, we're not going to appeal the award, but we're appealing litigation expenses. So that's why I ask about the meaning of that.
If we put aside for a moment the question of whether there is a jurisdictional offer in the case or not, the point of a final award in a condemnation commission is to bring to an end the advocacy process. And when that end is achieved, then you have the issue of the recovery of litigation expenses under 3228. So in another aspect of this, you could say that that final language also is part of the triggering mechanism for 3228.
So there's no appeal of the condemnation award. You're saying that means the dollar amount given by the condemnation commission. Is that right?
Yes, Chief Justice.
And then, if you want litigation expenses, do you ask the Condemnation Commission for litigation expenses?
No, you do not.
You go to court.
You go to court.
And the court's involved because initially you come to court.
It's actually involved because of a word in 3228. The word is reasonable.
Well,
and that drives the question of who should decide what's reasonable. And this court has in the past found its way to making that a circuit court activity.
Well, what's the authority of the Condemnation Commission?
Condemnation Commission serves as a non-judicial body, as an informal determiner of fair market value
That's
loss.
Limited function.
Very limited function.
That's why you don't go there.
Yes, Chief Justice, that's true.
And that's why you're in court anyway, because isn't the court that sets up the commission?
Actually, it's an administrative action. They set it up, and then they assign the case to the commission rather than supervise it.
The circuit court assigns the case to the commission.
Yes, Justice Bradley. In fact, under those circumstances, it actually doesn't have jurisdiction over the process.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walsh. Attorney Stephen Streck, representing American Transmission Company.
Good afternoon. May it please the court.
Sir.
My name is Steve Streck, along with my associate, Sarah Beachy. We represent the American Transmission Company, who is represented here by Teresa Kochaver, the director of the real estate division. 2 years ago, this court decided a case, it was a unit rule case involving the Milwaukee VFW post. And the court said, just compensation means compensation that would be just in regard to the public as well as in regard to the individual. And that's really, I think, the theme of our position on the issue that's before you today. This is a recognition that there are two competing interests whenever you have a dispute under Chapter 32, and I think it's a recognition that when the legislature drafted Chapter 32, it recognized that there were a lot of trade-offs. It couldn't be tilted toward the public or toward the landowner too much. There were a lot of policy decisions that the legislature had to make. The question before the court is, how do we interpret one of the statutes that the legislature drafted? I want to take about 2 minutes to give you just a little bit of background information. I think it puts our argument helps put perspective on our argument. When ATC acquires land interests for a project, it has to recognize the same competing interests that the legislature recognizes. It has to treat the landowners fairly, but it also has to spend its money prudently to protect its ratepayers, to protect the public. Probably everybody in this room, assuming they live in ATC's service territory, is part of that public. So ATC has to do that same balancing test, guided, of course, by the statutes. This particular project gave rise to this acquiring this interest in the Clem's land was called generally the Central Wisconsin Project. It was 100 miles of new transmission line running east from Wausau and then up into north central Wisconsin. There are hundreds of landowners involved, and ATC had to go out and get hundreds of new interests in property, new easements, to build this project. When ATC acquires these interests, the goal is always to get an agreed-upon price. They're very successful in that. Just like in this case, that's what they try to do. And for a very practical purpose, the ATC has a relationship with these landowners for years and perhaps for decades. They want a good relationship. Plus, it's easier to do business if they can get agreed upon prices. That's what they try to do. And as I believe the amicus attorney said in their brief, by far most of these transactions are agreed upon versus going the JO route. Far more agreed price transactions. In the course of negotiating with the landowners, and most of this is required by statute, get certain information. They get maps, whatever they want, any project information that they want, they can have. ATC will give them whatever they want. They get the names of at least 10 landowners, and typically ATC gives the names of all the landowners involved in the project, presumably in case the landowners want to compare notes and see what ATC is offering one versus the other. They also get a full narrative appraisal, and most importantly, the landowners get the opportunity to get their own appraisal on ATC's nickel. ATC has to pay for it by statute. Again, the goal is to arrive at a price, to negotiate with the landowners, to get a price that's acceptable by the landowner. If you get a price that's acceptable by the landowner, presumably there's not going to be an appeal. Sometimes the landowners will give ATC information during negotiations, which will cause ATC to go above its own appraisal amount. It happens all the time. It's very common. That's what negotiations are for. That's what the give and take is for. Rarely ATC has to issue a jurisdictional offer. Sometimes it does. But the point is, the give and take that I'm talking about didn't occur with the Clems. They accepted the first offer that ATC gave and then appealed. That's what happened. ATC is very motivated to give a fair price in the first place because in the long run it benefits all of us. It benefits the ratepayers because we don't have to go through litigation. Litigation with going the JO process is very costly.
Are you suggesting by that procedural information that there's an issue here about litigation, incurring litigation expense to fight litigation expense?
I guess
threw it in there as a little curve, and I want to
incurring litigation expense.
Well, by that I mean you said they didn't have to. Normally there's give and take.
Right.
Here there was no give and take. They took our first one, and then they appealed.
Right. What I'm suggesting is that if the party, if the parties follow what the legislature had in mind, this would never happen. We would not be before you today. If it works the way the legislature had in mind, we wouldn't be here.
How can that be? They followed everything according to the statute. They took the offer. They went. They waited their time. They went to court. They asked for condemnation commission under 3206-2A. They can then appeal that if they want to, but it's limited issues on appeal. How much and general authority, right? Not generally everything, limited issues on appeal. And they didn't appeal, but they went back to the court to get litigation costs. What did they do wrong here?
I think that if they had engaged in the negotiation process in the first place.
Why do they have to do that? Where in the statute does it say they have to do that?
The statute doesn't require the landowners to do that. It requires ATC to do it. What I'm telling you is that I think the legislature assumed that landowners would do that. And in that case, it explains why the legislature didn't give the agreed price landowners litigation expenses on appeal. I think it follows.
So your point is D does not cover 3206-2A proceedings.
Correct. And either way, whether ATC is successful in negotiating an agreed-upon easement or not, ATC doesn't have a financial stake in this. The ATC's rate holders do, but this is a pass-through cost for ATC. As long as they spend their money prudently, they can recover that money in rates. It doesn't affect ATC. ATC has to watch out for the public, though. I mean, that's one of their duties. But that's, in other words, ATC has to be fair, but to the landowner. But they also have to be fair to their ratepayers. It would have been real easy in this case for ATC to say, the Clems are nice people. Mr. Vanderwall is very easy to work with. Let's just pay the Clems litigation expenses. It would have been easy to do that. But if you look at the statute, we just couldn't get there.
Wouldn't it have been also easy after they appealed to say, well, how much money do you want here and to continue to negotiate? I mean, many cases get into litigation, but the parties continue to negotiate and many, many times settle the cases before they do get to any court.
We settled the cost of the easement, and frankly, we settled the cost of the easement because after the condemnation commission hearing, we understood why the easement was worth more than we initially offered. But ATC can't pay litigation expenses in one case and not in other cases. It's hard to describe. Let me try it. ATC is very, very, it's important to ATC to be very consistent with the way they treat all of the landowners. They pay landowners along a segment of their route on the same basis, unless it's a different type of land. But if it's all ag land, for example, they'll pay generally based on the same formula for all the landowners. If halfway through a project they find out that they should be paying more, they'll actually go back and true up with the people that have already settled. They'll pay them more money. It's very important for them to be consistent. That's why, Justice Rogasek, they can't pay the Clems litigation expenses if they truly don't believe they have them coming.
Well, I was thinking about before they got the $10,000 award from the Condemnation Commission. I mean, just because they appealed the $7,500 award, that doesn't mean that American Transmission couldn't have gone to their attorney and say, well, you know, what do you need to put this behind us? And give them a number and say, fine, we'll pay you that amount of money for the condemnation award.
But we have to have ATC has to have a reason to do that.
Well, they can't they had some evidence that they based it on because they did okay before the commission.
Well, they got $2,200 or thereabouts more. We didn't get their appraisal until just before the commission hearing. That's why we didn't settle.
Okay, all right. Well, that's a good answer. Thank you.
Do you think that the Clems accepted the highest written offer prior to the jurisdictional offer?
No.
Why not?
No, I don't.
Okay. What did they accept?
They accepted our initial offer.
Was it in writing?
Well, that's not in the record. And to be honest with you, I don't know that for a fact, but I imagine it was. It usually is. It's usually in the form of some kind of worksheet that the land acquisition specialist will use when they meet with the landowners. So presumably there was something in writing. I don't know.
You know, in the briefs, they go through the statutory language and they go through the general policy of just compensation, but that doesn't include litigation expenses ordinarily, right?
Right.
And that the legislature has to provide for litigation expenses, and they do in Wisconsin in a limited number of instances. And what I hear you saying now, and maybe it's in the brief and I just, for the details, missed the big picture, is that doesn't matter what happens in the Condemnation Commission in 2A, that the litigation expenses just don't cover anything under 2A.
Correct.
If you take that route, you are out. If you want litigation expenses, you've got to wait for the jurisdictional offer. Now, what is the advantage to the state for the agreed price? Why would the state give you that alternative of an agreed price rather than a jurisdictional offer? Is it faster? Is it cheaper? And for whom?
An agreed price is cheaper.
For whom?
For the acquiring utility, for ATC.
Condemnor.
Pardon me?
For the condemnor.
Condemnor, yes.
Why?
Well, it's less burdensome. There's fewer transactional costs. When ATC's land acquisition specialists go, they make an initial contact. There's several contacts back and forth. There's several meetings and potentially during those negotiations. They do that whether a jurisdictional offer is eventually issued or not.
But if it's cheaper for you to do the agreed price,
right,
and you've offered in the agreed price an amount that's less than $700 and the 15%, then why shouldn't you pay litigation expenses? The whole point of this clause is to make sure you're fair.
Correct. You're exactly right. The policy is to ensure that landowners are made whole, mm-hmm, who are forced to litigate.
That's right.
These people were not forced to litigate.
Sure they were. They had to go to the Condemnation Commission to get $2,200 extra dollars.
Well, I respectfully disagree with you.
Why?
Had they entered into negotiations, ATC would have found out why.
Yeah, but as Justice Rogensack said, you're not barred from negotiations once they ask for a condemnation commission. You still can negotiate with them. You can still go to the Condemnation Commission, I assume, and say, hey, we've made a deal. We don't need you. I don't think the commission is going to say, we've got the case. Now it's ours.
Oh, sure. We could have. Sure. I agree with you. We could have done that at any time.
Counsel, can you help me out? I'm sort of stuck on this written offer thing. The electric transmission line easement has a certificate of compensation and a notice of right to appeal. It has attached to it what the easement will be. It describes your duties under 182.017 sub 7. It describes the easement in Exhibit B, the easement description map, and then Exhibit C is the certificate of compensation that says the total consideration paid for such easement was, and then it's blacked out. And then immediately under that, it talks about the notice of right to appeal, and the notice of right to appeal is in accordance with 32062A. And that was drafted by ATC. So what am I missing?
I'm not sure what your question is, Justice Ziegler.
Why isn't that an offer in writing, and why is it wrong that they appealed under 32062A when that's where you directed them to appeal if they wanted to appeal?
The statute gives them the right to appeal under that, under 32.06 sub A, sub 2A rather.
Okay.
I believe we're required to put that in the certificate of compensation to notify the landowners that they do have that right to appeal.
But that's not a written offer prior to jurisdictional offer?
No, because there was no jurisdictional offer.
If they accept a written offer, I'm missing something here, because it seems to me the way it works is you say, I want to put this line through your front yard. Here's how much we'll pay you. And they say, okay. And they take that, and you give them this easement, and it says, here's how much we'll pay you, and here's your right to appeal that. And then they appeal that. Why would there be a jurisdictional offer after you've done this and told them about their right to appeal? Why would you then, after this, give them a jurisdictional offer?
We would never do that. There is two completely different roads. One
so if someone agrees early with you and appeals, they don't get their fees. But if someone negotiates with you or waits and doesn't say anything to you and waits for a jurisdictional offer, and then they appeal, then they do get their fees.
That's your position. We think that's what the statute says. And we think that's one of the trade-offs the legislature made. And frankly, I think the question is, why did the legislature give landowners in the Clems position the right to appeal to begin with? I struggled a lot with that question. And of course, there's no answer. You have to speculate. But I don't think that statute was even written with the Clems in mind.
Well,
I think it was written for...
Go ahead.
I think it was written for the legislature had in mind anybody else that had an interest in the property being condemned, particularly mortgagees, who aren't involved in the process at all until the certificate of compensation, in this case under 2A, is filed. The mortgagee has to be everybody who has an interest in the land, leaseholders, whatever, have to be given notice, and they all have the right to appeal. I think the legislature was thinking of the mortgagee, saying, perhaps the mortgagee is going to think that the condemnation affected their security for the loan, and they were given an opportunity to appeal. That's what I think.
That's why I asked you, who benefits from the agreed price route? You say you do, because it's going to be faster.
And the landowners.
Well, so both of them benefit, both of you benefit. And so why shouldn't the same rules apply? Why shouldn't the legislature intend the same rules to apply about litigation costs? That puts the heat on you to make a reasonable offer, right?
Right.
Reasonable means good for the property owner and good for the ratepayers in your example. And one way to keep the heat on you to be reasonable is to say you're unreasonable, and unreasonable is defined as $700.15. You pay. And in this example, you're paying more in litigation costs than you are paying in for the land.
That's true.
And anytime you have a relatively small amount of money, that's going to happen, but you might even have it on something worth $100,000. I can see litigation costs going that high with appraisal fees and lawyers, can't you?
What was the figure, Justice?
$100,000.
Yes, I've seen that, yes.
For a piece of land of $100,000, litigation costs, if you're going to fight it, can be that much.
It certainly could.
And you're forcing the owner to go the route of jurisdictional offer, which is not good for you, in order to make sure that they can recover litigation expenses if you're wrong.
Right, but I think the assumption under 2A is that whatever the landowner agrees to accept is acceptable to the landowner.
Yes, I share with you. I have two thoughts about how odd 2A is. One is that agreed upon offer, one would think, is agreed upon as opposed to, oh, we can agree upon this offer and then we can immediately appeal. That I don't understand that. The other thing I don't understand on 2A, and maybe you can elucidate since you two are perplexed by the same thing I just voiced. The other thing is, under 2A, it seems as though the legislature is requiring you to just really be very careful with the landowner and give them everything and make sure they know what they're doing. 2A requires you've got to give them this pamphlet. 2A that explains the procedure. 2A requires that you have to give them the list of homeowners or representatives with the names of at least 10 neighboring landowners to whom offers are made. You have to also show them maps and make them available to them. You have to give them names of other owners. So it's just very careful. Now make sure they have all the information they need. And then, but it doesn't say, oh, by the way, if you agree upon price, you don't get any litigation costs. You know, I'd trade you 10 maps for litigation costs. So that doesn't make any sense to me. Can you explain to me why it's so careful in making sure they understand everything, and yet what's exceedingly important, arguably, isn't mentioned? Can you?
All I can say,
if your interpretation is correct, that is.
Yeah. All I can say, Justice Bradley, is that I think the legislature wanted to give the landowner every opportunity, wanted to make sure that the acquiring the condominor was fair, and wanted to give the landowner every opportunity to get information, become informed, and to know what its property was worth. Most landowners do, and form in their own mind what they think is a fair dollar amount for that easement.
And all the rights and procedures. You have to give them the notice of appeal. You have to send that.
Right.
I can't remember if it's in certified mail or something. But it's all a very delicate procedure, I think.
I think so, too.
But then what about this, if your interpretation is correct?
Well, why give them the right to appeal?
Well, like I said, Justice Abrahamson, I don't think the legislature ever thought that the Clems, the landowners in the position of the Clems would appeal. It's an agreed-upon price that presumably is acceptable to them.
Well, that was the point that I was raising earlier. I mean, you specifically, right after you give them the price, you give them the right to appeal. For what?
Because that's what the legislature required?
That,
we don't know why. I told you why I thought there was a right to appeal.
Let me ask you this, and this is in the briefs. The statute uses the same phrase, the highest written offer prior to the jurisdictional offer, right?
Right.
That's used in several places in the condemnation statute.
Right.
And one of the things that worries me, but I have not in my own mind gone through every single phrase, which I think has to be done in writing an opinion, to see that we use the same definition of that phrase. So if we interpret 3228(3)(d) to mean the 2A alternative, does it mean the 2A alternative in all the other places this is used? Or is that phrase used differently in the statutes?
I'm not aware of it being used in any other statute.
In condemnation? In these proceedings?
That concept that a written offer before the jurisdictional offer?
No. But the phrase, written offer prior to jurisdictional, I may be wrong, but I thought, and I will ask Mr. Vandewall, that his brief says, and I thought I checked it through his brief, that this language is used elsewhere in the statutes, and therefore in context you have to use the same kind of definition. Okay?
May I go on?
Yes, of course.
I've got the yellow light, so my time is short.
You've got about four or five minutes. Go ahead, counsel. Okay.
I'd like to make at least two points before I sit down. First of all, you can count me as somebody who doesn't believe that the statute is ambiguous. So
okay.
That's, now we have four.
Now we got, yeah, right, on each side.
Right.
All right.
Right. But that's, that. I think that to get to the results for the Clem, you either have to add words to the statute or you have to ignore some words. I think you have to add the words, if any, for example, after mm-hmm. jurisdictional offer.
Right.
And I think if you accept Mr. Vandewall's argument that it's the jurisdictional offer or the highest written offer, period, you're ignoring what follows. Before the jurisdictional offer, you have to ignore those words. And I don't think under the rules of statutory construction you can do that.
Are jurisdictional offers ever lower than the written offer before it?
It could be. It very well could be. It could be higher. Each condemner does it differently.
Would a jurisdictional offer only come after an agreed price failed?
Yes.
So a written offer after, let me get back to I think Justice Ziegler, I need your glasses to see this.
I don't have them.
Anyway, there used to be some words there. It says written offer.
Highest written offer prior to.
Okay, thank you. That's what I was looking for. And so, I mean, my question was after a jurisdictional offer would come after an agreed upon price. So that means an agreed upon written offer would become prior to any jurisdictional offer. Is that right?
Well, if there is an agreed upon offer, there is no jurisdictional offer.
I know that. I'm just not I understand that, but I'm just wondering, by definition, any written offer comes prior to a jurisdictional offer. By definition, I mean, that's the way the process works.
Right.
Any written offer is going to be prior to a jurisdictional offer.
That's true.
So if you read that together as any written offer prior to a jurisdictional offer, that's all written orders, offers are prior to
jurisdictional offers.
Correct, and that's the Clem's argument.
Mm-hmm. So really, aren't you asking us to write a case that basically says to people, don't accept offers, make sure you get a jurisdictional one, and then appeal it so you can get your attorney's fees if you win?
Well, that's
what... Are you saying don't ever settle with ATC?
No, but let me add one phrase to that, and then I would agree with you. We're saying don't accept ATC's offer unless it's acceptable to you. And if it isn't, tell us why. And if we can't pay what you think your property is worth, then we'll serve a JO on you, a jurisdictional offer.
Right.
We want people who accept our offers to be happy with our offers. We don't want to have to go through litigation after we have an accepted offer.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as that. I'm going to make one more real quick point. And it's touched on in our brief. The legislature made all these changes to the Chapter 32 in 1970. I'm sorry, my time is up.
You may conclude their sentence and thought, counsel.
Thank you. In 1977, the legislature made all these changes. In 1973, the legislature had already changed the inverse condemnation statute. The inverse condemnation statute basically says if you believe a person with condemning authority is on your property without the right to do so, you file a petition with a court. The court essentially makes a determination whether or not the condemning authority has the right to be on your property. If not, the statute says you assume, Chapter 32 applies, you use Chapter 32 procedures as if a jurisdictional offer was served and rejected by the landowner. And the legislature added 32.28 sub 3 sub C, which says under those circumstances, under inverse condemnation, if the landowner is successful, they get fees. They get their litigation expenses. So the point is this. The legislature knew when it did these changes to Chapter 32 in 1977 how to deal with instances where there would be no jurisdictional offer. They knew how to do that. And in this case, with agreed-on prices, knowing how to deal with that, they didn't include expressly that people who settled on an agreed-on price was entitled to litigation expenses.
In reality, jurisdictional offers can be less than a prior written offer.
Not always.
No. Sometimes.
You could, sure.
That's what I'm asking. And you think that's what this covers, the example I gave you, where you got a written offer, it was high. You get a jurisdictional offer that's lower, right?
Absolutely. I think that's a protection for the landowner. The landowner essentially can recover litigation expenses if it exceeds the threshold of either the written offer before or the jurisdictional offer. I think it benefits the landowner.
Justice Prosser.
3206. Is entitled Condemnation Procedure in Other Than Transportation Matters. Could you give some examples of what other than transportation matters are?
Sure. The University of Wisconsin has condemning authority. The Board of Regents have. There are certain boards, statutory boards, that have condemning authority. They're listed in 3202. There are all sorts of different statutorily created boards and commissions that have condemning authority that I frankly have never even heard of, most of them.
Well, this isn't a transportation case, is it?
Correct. We're under 32.06. And the statutes, some of these condemning authorities can operate under either one, which they can choose. 3205 is generally DOT and transportation type things. 3206 is always what we operate under.
Do you have any statistics on how long it takes when someone is proceeding under 3206 2A as opposed to going through the whole process of getting a jurisdictional offer and then maybe litigating it?
I don't. I've never seen them, Justice Prosser. I'm sorry.
The affidavit from the Clems talks about it was my understanding and belief that ATC wanted to begin construction of the electric transmission line as soon as practical.
Right.
Wouldn't it go faster if people were under 2A?
I mean, no.
Let's suppose you talked about the University of Wisconsin condemning land. If I had land and the University of Wisconsin wanted it, you know, I'm a badger. But I also want to be paid fairly.
Right.
I don't want to hold up the project,
right.
But I want to be paid fairly. Wouldn't I want to go under 2A?
Not necessarily. The landowner could say, look, what you're offering me is not acceptable to me. But if you want possession, if you want to enter my land, feel free. Go ahead and do it. That happens all the time. All the time. They can give us possession of the property without having settled yet.
You can get possession even if they don't want to give you possession, because the fact that you can't agree on a price does not stop the condemnor from getting the property.
We have to serve it. To get possession, we have to serve a JO.
That's right.
We have to wait the 20 days if they don't accept,
sure.
And then we petition the court, correct?
That's right. So you don't have to wait until you negotiate out how much you're going to pay ultimately,
sure.
When I say negotiate. Because you can get possession. That's the whole point of these statutes, so that you don't have to wait 5 or 10 years while the proceedings are in due course.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
So is that sentence in the affidavit of Mr. Clem just kind of self-serving?
I thought it was. I've only met Mr. Clem very briefly when we were on his property, and I can't speak for him. I don't know. It seemed to me it was.
Most affidavits are self-serving. Any other questions, comments? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Van de Waal.
Good afternoon. I would like to briefly address a few of the comments and try to address some of the questions the justices had for Mr. Streck. First of all, I want to very briefly set the backdrop. A property owner, more likely than not, is going to go through this process once in their lifetime. American Transmission Company, the state of Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin, routinely does this. The legislative history acknowledges that fact. They have legal counsel, staff counsel, they have appraisers on board. A property owner goes through this once in their life. Mr. Streck and ATC urges the court to adopt a reading of 3228.3d that simply doesn't exist. I don't have the time, and I think it's been fully briefed, relative to the two ways in which you get in front of a condemnation commission under 3206 and other than transportation matter. The point is that if the legislature intended the only way to obtain litigation expenses were to go through the jurisdictional offer process and then have ATC petition the court under sub 7, the statute would simply say the award of the condemnation commission under 3206 sub 8 pursuant to 3206 sub 7. There's one of two ways. It's 2A or sub 7. If the legislature intended that, in fact, the legislature could have made it even less wordy and simply said 3206 sub 7 if it exceeds the jurisdictional offer or the highest written offer before that. But it doesn't. It says for the condemnation commission, indicating that both routes get us to the same end. The Court of Appeals in footnote 7 took me to task, took the Clems to task about the cost and the effort the Clems thought they were trying to save. And Justice Prosser, I agree with you. Maybe Mr. Clem's affidavit was self-serving. As the joke goes, I hope so. I was his lawyer. I helped draft it. But you also heard Mr. Streck acknowledge that what we all know. He acknowledged at the beginning of his argument, jurisdictional offer method is a costly method. Property owners don't appreciate that. Property owners have the negotiating agent from American Transmission coming out to their land, jovially telling them, providing them with all of the information, Justice Bradley, that the statute requires. And in my respectful opinion, the legislature's attempt to try to equalize the bargaining power. These people have never gone through this before. They come out, they explain the process, we want an easement, whether you want to sell it or not, we're taking your land, and we want to get going and start this project right away. We can either do this the hard way or we can do this the easy way. ATC has told you today what Justice Hoover, and I've been arguing since day one, the jurisdictional offer route is a costly route. And unfortunately, it's the attitude of, well, we'll just pass this on to the ratepayers. We'll pass this on to the taxpayers. It's really not a cost for us. But what these property owners are losing is their land. And it is a cost to them. And the question is whether it's an agreed-upon price. The question is whether it's just compensation when the government, when American Transmission Company, takes your land against your will. That's the issue. And if they do, and you are forced to litigate that issue, and if only if you are successful, then and only then, the legislature and this court has repeatedly said, the property owner who this has happened to is entitled to be made whole and does not have to dig into that just compensation fund. It's not the agreed price, and I appreciate, Justice Bradley, that that's what the language 2A says, agreed price. But agreed price and just compensation are sometimes different. That's why the legislature gave the 2A. The Clems aren't 90-year-old people who have this one little piece of land, but they are hardworking people who have never gone through this. They came and they saw attorney. We achieved just compensation. And therefore, Your Honors, we would ask that 3228 be read under the plain language of that statute and entitle them to be made whole. Thank you.
According to the circuit court. Is that right?
I only had a few minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Attorneys Van de Waal, Roth, and Streck for excellent arguments on a provision that we've dealt with before, but not under these fact situations of litigation costs, which can be a substantial amount of money, as we all agree. And that concludes our argument in 09-AP-2784, Mark Clem versus American Transmission Company, LLC. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when we will have another set of arguments. And if I may confer, do you want a full half hour for this?
15-20 minutes.
Okay. The court will meet in conference at 5:05. And so that ends our hearing today.